Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Pamela Bergman, and I'm your host for the Quantitative Leap series of webinars, which are exploring how math policies can strengthen the transition between high school and college. We have two sponsors for the series, the Opportunity Institute, a nonprofit that promotes social mobility and equity by improving educational opportunity and outcomes, and I'm speaking to you from their beautiful downtown Berkeley location today. And our other sponsor is LearningWorks, an Oakland-based partnership that aims to strengthen student achievement in community colleges. These webinars grew out of a policy brief I wrote and LearningWorks published. Support for the webinars comes from the James Irvine and the College Futures Foundation. Thank you to the sponsors and funders. Webinar one in the series looked at how states are rethinking their post-secondary mathematics sequences and tailoring them to students' programs of study. If you missed that webinar, you can find the recording on our sponsors' websites. A related issue is mathematics placement exams, and that is our focus for today. There we go. Math placement has been targeted for increased scrutiny because of the high proportion of students who place into developmental math and the low success rates in these courses. These placements disproportionately affect students of color. It's become clear that math placement is a very high-stakes proposition with serious equity implications. My Quantitative Leap policy brief recommended that institutions ensure the validity and efficacy of the measures they use to determine students' readiness, with an eye toward removing unnecessary barriers to completion. The goal of the recommendation and our conversation today is to promote improvements in practice and policy that would allow more students to place into college-level math courses while providing students with the quantitative foundation they need for success in college and in life. To help us explore these questions, we have four leading researchers with us today. First, Judith Scott Clayton. Judith is an associate professor of economics and education at Columbia University. Judith's research on placement for the Community College Research Center beginning around 5 years ago was instrumental in opening up the examination of testing more broadly. And one of her reports also provided the title for our webinar today. So thanks for that, Judith. Judith will share some of that research in a moment. But first, let me introduce our second panelist, Michelle Hedera. Michelle is a senior researcher at Education Northwest up in Portland. She also comes from and continues to work with CCRC at Columbia. And with Shauna Smith-Jaggers, she developed a framework that helps illustrate some of the trade-offs involved in remedial placement, and she's going to present it for us today. Our final two speakers are going to provide some context for how this type of research may influence placement practices in community colleges and universities. First, John Hetz. John began his work on the topic while at Long Beach City College, and he now is Director of Data Science for Educational Results Partnership, where he works with colleges around California on multiple measures assessment. And lastly, Eric Hsu. Eric is a professor of mathematics at SF State, where he also directs the Center for Science and Math Education. He has written about math placement, and he also sits on a statewide committee that develops Cal State's entry-level mathematics exam. Eric is going to share some thoughts from a four-year university perspective, since so much of the research and innovation regarding placement recently has been based at two-year colleges. Following that, we will have time for Q&A. Please note that you can submit questions at any point during the webinar using the control panel on your screen. And it's helpful if you can note to whom your question is addressed. And with that, I am going to turn the mic over to Judith Scott Clayton in New York. Welcome, Judith.
Thank you, Pamela, for that introduction. It's my pleasure to be here today. And thanks, everyone, for your interest in this topic. Just to provide a little bit of background while we're getting the slides queued up here on kind of how I got into this research as a new faculty member at Columbia and a new research associate at CCRC, was not particularly an expert in community colleges at the time, and maybe that, you know, enabled me to kind of bring some fresh eyes to some puzzles that had been ongoing in the field at the time around the issue of remediation. Remediation being one of, if not the most widespread and costly single intervention aimed at improving college success in the United States, and I probably don't need to explain to this crowd kind of what remediation is, but basically courses that are intended to address incoming students' skill deficiencies cost money and require time on the part of both students and faculty, but don't result in college credit. About half of all undergraduates across all types of institutions, 2- and 4-year level, about half of all incoming students will take at least one remedial course during their time enrolled, and on average, those who do take a remedial course take about 2.6 courses each. And the puzzle that kind of brought me to this research was that there was some evidence suggesting that students who are assigned to remediation, even when you kind of compare students just around the cutoff for remediation, so those who just barely were assigned, it didn't look like, despite this extra kind of treatment that they're getting, that they were that their improvement was significantly increased in their subsequent coursework. And so the puzzle was, why does this seem like it's not working? And the perspective that I took to it was kind of thinking about how much of this could be just due to how we're selecting, how we're deciding which students should take remedial courses and what attention has been paid to that process. Of course, there's been tons of attention always given to the SAT and the ACT, but there are millions of students taking these remedial placement exams every year, and there wasn't a lot of research about them and their accuracy, their validity, and how they're being used in practice. So that was kind of how I got started on this. We kind of have already talked through these first couple bullets. I'm not seeing the little arrow button. Where is that arrow button? Can I advance the slide to the next slide? Let's see. Okay. Whoops. Too fast.
Judith, click on your trackpad, okay. And that'll work.
I'm here. Okay. Sorry about that. All right. So, of course, there's never going to be a perfect way to know in advance which students are likely to benefit from any given treatment, and this is a well-known complication in medical research where the concept of finding an effective treatment, a lot of that depends upon your ability to diagnose who's likely to benefit from that. So this is not a problem that's unique to education. And of course, there are always going to be mistakes made in both directions. So there are always going to be some students, no matter what you do, that you're going to assign to college-level course, even though they're not really prepared for it. And that's the side of the issue that had, until more recently, that's the side where a lot of our efforts have been focused, on the underprepared students that show up in college-level classes and don't succeed there. And, of course, that could have consequences for them personally, but it also has consequences potentially for how those courses are taught. If too many unprepared students are in the class, the whole kind of way that the instruction is delivered may change in a way that negatively affects other students in the class as well. But at the time that I began this research, there wasn't a ton of attention given to the other type of mistake that can be made in this situation, which are the students who actually were prepared for college or prepared enough to do well in a college class, but are mistakenly assigned by the placement system to take a remedial course. And at some level, these types of mistakes are harder to see. So this is a student who shows up in a remedial class who's actually doing just fine, And on the ground level, that may appear like a success. That may not appear like it's a big problem. But from kind of a stepping back, what that means for the student is that they might not receive a lot of benefit from taking that class. And at the same time, it may delay their program of study and potentially even discourage them from going further if they see they have to take a really long remedial sequence before they can get to college-level courses. Okay, so in the research that I conducted with my colleagues at the Community College Research Center, we really turned our attention to trying to understand the accuracy of the so-called assignment mechanism, or the placement exams that are determining remedial versus college-level assignment. And what we did was we took advantage of rich administrative data sources that included information on both high school background and college performance and remedial assignment. And what we did was we put together a rich model that we used to predict students' performance in college-level courses. And then we asked, how accurate are placement exams at distinguishing between students who are likely or unlikely to succeed? Beyond that, how much better could we do by incorporating additional information, in particular from high school transcripts, into the screening process? And then, if we have a little bit of time at the end, another question we were, at least that I was interested in as a researcher, what do the way current policies are set up, what does that imply about kind of institutions' own implied preferences or kind of beliefs about the costs of different types of assignment errors? And one thing that was immediately surprising to us in this research was how little high school transcript info had been incorporated into the placement decision-making process. And this was surprising to us because even though high school information is often considered more subjective than test scores, in many ways it can be less noisy because it's a combination of many assessments of the student's performance from different instructors over a relatively long period of time as opposed to just kind of a one-off test. And it's also incorporating other aspects that might be important for college success, including persistence and motivation, beyond just kind of raw measure of ability or preparation. And finally, there is evidence from the SAT and the ACT that high school GPA may be a better predictor of college success compared to those exams. So that's kind of where we're starting from. So what we do is we look at students who already are taking college-level courses and look at how do the placement test scores, how do high school transcript information relate to those college outcomes. And then we use that relationship to extrapolate to those who are not placed directly into college-level. Based on their high school performance and their test scores, how do we think they would have done in college-level? And then we simulate different remedial screening policies, either based just on test scores, based on a combination of test scores and high school transcripts, or based on high school transcripts alone, to compute a number of different validity metrics, which we'll talk through in a minute, to evaluate outcomes under these alternative policies. And we're using data for this from two separate large community college systems, so it's multiple institutions, not just one or two, and using multiple different types of tests. So I'm only going to talk about one system and one test for this webinar, but we do have research that was using the AccuPlacer as well as the Compass exam and in different institutions other than the ones I'm talking about today. So we think this is not a really idiosyncratic result that we're finding. Okay, so to talk about kind of how we're thinking about these validity metrics, you can think about classifying students based on both our model that predicts their likelihood of success in college courses and then lining that up against how they're actually assigned, whether they're assigned to remediation or college level. And of those who are predicted to succeed in college level courses, if they're placed into remediation, they'll be in box, classified in box two here, which is an underplacement. Somebody who could have done just fine in a college level course. And for what I'll show you on the next slide, we're talking just fine means they could have gotten a B or better. So not just kind of okay, not just barely passing, but they could have gotten a B or better in the college level course, but they're assigned to remediation. We're calling that a severe underplacement. On the other side are those who are not predicted to succeed in college level courses, but because there's error in the test scores, they're assigned to college level anyway. They happen to do well on the exam, even though they're not prepared, and we're calling those severe overplacements. Those are students who fail in the college level course, even though they're assigned there. And again, there's always going to be both types of these errors going on, but we're interested in trying to quantify how important they are and how they vary depending upon the tool used. Okay, so here is one table from one of our papers that's illustrating the sorts of metrics that we look at from this analysis. So this table, I'm going to show you three columns, and this is looking at these different metrics under three scenarios. The first is the baseline using just test scores alone, which is what the system that we're looking at was using at the time we looked at them. And then hidden behind these gray boxes will be our simulations of what would happen if they used either high school measures alone or if they used a combination of both high school and test scores. And you can see here we've done this for both math and English, although since this call is focusing on math remediation, we can focus on the top panel. I will say that everything looks a lot, generally looks much, placement is much more difficult in English. But we'll focus on math for now. So the first thing we look at is a severe error rate, and that's the combination of both types of mistakes. So what this is saying is for every 100 students who take the math placement exam, almost 1 in 4 of them are severely erroneously placed. And the two lines below that, you can see that that's mostly due to severe underplacements. So 18%, or about 1 in 5 students who takes the math placement exam in this system, is placed into remediation even though they could have earned a B or better in the college level course. Of course, there are overplacements too, but those appear much smaller in comparison. And then also just for context, we've shown here the percentage of students who, if they're assigned to college level, get at least a C or better there. That's about 2/3 or 67%. And the remediation rate in this system is quite high at 76%. Okay, so now we hold that remediation rate basically fixed, but say what would happen if we picked students not based on test scores but based on these other metrics. And what you can see there is slight improvements as we move across the columns here. The severe error rate goes down by about 10%. It's not necessarily earth-shattering, but there is an improvement. Potentially more interesting here is at the same time you're reducing those severe errors, you're also improving the rate of students doing well in the college level course. So the second column would be, what if you threw away the test scores and only used high school information? And the third column is combining the two. Of course, now you may be thinking, well, this says that's great. But if we already are using the test, why would we want to shake things up just to get this kind of what looks like a fairly modest improvement? And what I would say to that is that, actually, I'm going to stick on this table and just talk through the next slide a bit. So the analyses in this table are holding the remediation rate fixed and saying, what happens if, you know, we're still assigning 2/3 of our testers to remediation, but we're going to use some different tool to pick out who goes where. But that's kind of putting an artificial constraint on the system. What we found when we looked into this further is that there's actually a wide range of remediation rates that results in relatively similar placement accuracy rates. So if you allow yourself to vary the threshold for remediation, what we found is you could actually kind of use this modest improvement in the college level success rate to say, okay, we can afford to lower our remediation rate now. And it turns out you can lower the remediation rate quite significantly while still maintaining a similar college level success rate. So you really get the biggest bang by combining both the use of multiple measures and relaxing the threshold for remediation.
Judy, can we yes. move to your summary?
Yes. I already talked through that slide, so we are to the summary. The bottom line here is it's not easy under any conditions to predict who will succeed in college. But we find that high school transcript information is at least as useful as and often superior to test scores. At the time we did this research, it was based on simulations. We weren't really sure was this going to hold up in practice? So I think there's been work done since this came out that has furthered our confidence in these findings and suggests that they do actually hold up in practice. So I'll stop there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Judy. That was a wonderful overview of the issue. And I want to remind people, if you have questions, you can type them in on the GoToWebinar control panel. Our next speaker is going to be Michelle Hedera. And if you're ready, Michelle, we're ready for you.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Pam. All righty. So hi, everyone. My name is Michelle Hodera, and I'm going to give you a brief overview of a report I co-authored with Shauna Smith-Jaggers. So we'll wait here. So what I'm going to talk about is tensions that shape developmental education policy, what we call the opposing forces. This research was based on a mixed method study at the City University of New York, but these themes tend to apply to colleges nationwide. In the study, we set forth what we call the opposing forces framework, which lays out the three pairs of opposing forces. We call them forces because within each set, each goal is important and worthy, championed by key stakeholders in the system, and has a direct impact on developmental education. We call them opposing because these goals tend to work in opposition to one another. So today I'll describe these opposing forces and give some examples of how to resolve them. And these examples may give you some ideas about how to approach the trade-offs you may be experiencing as you reform developmental education in your own context. Okay. All right, so the first set of forces is system-wide consistency versus institutional autonomy. I'm going to begin with the case for system-wide consistency. So common entry-level standards send a consistent message to high schools regarding standards of college readiness, make it more feasible for systems to track student performance across colleges, and smooth the process of transfer between colleges. Overall, system-wide consistency may reduce inequity and confusion for students. So the California State University system does this very well with their common assessments and cut scores. However, a tension exists between system-wide consistency and institutional autonomy. Some level of institutional autonomy may be appropriate, particularly when there's no research-based consensus on the most effective developmental policies and practices. So until best practices and strategies are established and proven, consistency of entry-level standards and developmental policy and programming may guarantee uniform implementation of ineffective policies. So institutional autonomy allows each college to tailor its entry-level standards and developmental policy, course structures, and curriculum to meet the needs of its particular mix of students. But then we go back to the tension, because in doing so, colleges squander the benefits of system-wide consistency. So how do you resolve this tension? So I'm going to talk to you about an example from New Jersey. And also discussions like ones the California Community Colleges are engaging in through the Common Assessment Initiative that involves diverse stakeholders from across colleges in the state are important for thinking about policies and practices that might work for students in multiple contexts. But let me tell you about a story from New Jersey that we learned about from some of our assessment research. So New Jersey community colleges a while back varied widely on the assessments, cut scores, and testing policies they use to assess student readiness and place students. So what New Jersey did is faculty from across the state came together to decide on a common assessment and cutoff scores for placement into college coursework. And in doing so, they ended up having much deeper conversations about the college curriculum, the skills students need to be successful in the curriculum, and the types of academic interventions that could help students succeed in that curriculum. After a year-long process of discussion, the colleges came to an agreement on a common assessment and cut scores. After using the assessment they chose, which was AccuPlacer, and common cut scores, the community colleges had the College Board do a statewide validity study on their new cutoffs and found that they were not very predictive, which then led the state to voluntarily adopt decision zones around the cutoff where the colleges could use multiple measures, such as high school GPA, to determine students' placement. So in other words, New Jersey adopted a common assessment and cut scores, but colleges use their own discretion when students score around the cutoff about which measures and cutoffs to use to determine if students are ready for college coursework. So this is just one example of balancing system-wide consistency with some level of institutional autonomy. So the next tension is between efficient and effective assessment. So nearly all community colleges and many broad access universities use standardized tests to assess the academic preparedness of incoming students. These tests allow colleges to assess thousands of entering students quickly and cheaply and instantaneously determine the course placement for each student. So this is the, can we go back? So this is the case for efficient assessment. The fact that you can assess student readiness very quickly. But this administrative efficiency goes hand in hand with high rates of failure and attrition. And a big reason for this is because these exams don't actually predict student performance as well as we might wish. And Judy just showed this in her presentation. So the case for effective assessment is that test validity is low, and this might be for a number of reasons. So some hypotheses are that, you know, students do not prepare for tests, and so their performance does not actually reflect their true capabilities. Another reason is that the standardized exams may not measure all the skills that students that determine college readiness, such as non-cognitive competencies. So how do you resolve this tension? So one way is to use high school transcript information to improve placement accuracy, as Judy showed, and our next presenters are going to show this in more depth, so I'm not going to talk about it. But using multiple measures is one way to continue to have an efficient assessment process that is more effective and more accurately places students into the coursework that they are prepared for and can succeed in. Okay, so the final tension is between supporting progression versus upholding standards. So I'm going to start with the case for supporting progression. So there's a national push to increase college completion, but this is hampered by high rates of remediation. Nationwide, we found that only 28% of developmental education students earn a credential, and the longer the remedial sequence, the less likely students are to complete it and enroll and complete college-level courses. Reforms like multiple measures and acceleration models that shorten the developmental education sequence are designed to support access to college coursework and overall progression. And indeed, emerging research shows very promising effects of multiple measures and acceleration on student entry and completion of college English and math and other long-term college outcomes. However, a common concern is that these reforms may result in a greater number of underprepared students in college classes, and faculty may then be faced with a choice between relaxing standards or failing a large number of students, which could result in higher numbers of students dropping out. So how do you resolve this tension between supporting progression and upholding standards? So expanding access while providing student support can improve progression and uphold standards. This webinar is about math placement, but I'm just going to show you evidence of this from Chabot College's accelerated English model. So CCRC and other researchers have looked at acceleration models that shorten the developmental education sequence in many states, and they all result in more students passing college English and math, in part because more students are allowed access into those courses. But high-quality acceleration models also ensure students who enroll in the college course succeed. For example, Chabot College offers two developmental English pathways to students. The traditional pathway consists of two semesters of developmental English, and the accelerated pathway consists of one semester. Both sequences are aligned with college-level English, and students are given the same types of assignments they would receive in college English and provided with scaffolded instruction and detailed feedback on their assignments. Faculty want all developmental education students to work with college-level tasks and materials in a supportive environment. So when we looked at the data on enrollment and completion for these students, we found that there's a huge difference. Many more students from the accelerated pathways are enrolling in college-level English than students from the non-accelerated pathway. You can see that's 59% compared to 25%. However, when we zero in on the pass rates of students who enroll in college English, you can see on the right that a higher proportion of students from the accelerated pathway who enrolled in college English pass than students from the non-accelerated track, 77% compared to 73%. So I'm just showing you this example to show that even that expanding access through strategies such as multiple measures and acceleration can lead to improvements in both access and progression when students are provided appropriate scaffolding and supports. So I'm going to leave you with just a few questions to ponder, and then we can go to the next presenter. So just to end, when you think about, as you think about redesigning placement and developmental education, you might want to think about, you know, what value do you see in creating statewide consistency around the placement process? What would be the ideal process for determining the college readiness of incoming students? And what kind of structures would support faculty as they work to both uphold academic standards and promote student progression? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I appreciate our two presenters so far. Now, our next two presenters are going to talk more about what's happening on the ground in the systems where they work, and we're going to start with John Hetz of the Educational Results Partnership.
Hello everyone. John. Hi.
Hi there. Can you get your first slide?
I'm trying.
Okay.
There we go.
There it is.
Okay. First of all, I just wanted to make sure to recognize that this work represents the work of a great number of people, both in my previous work at Long Beach City College, a fantastic group of faculty, administrators, and staff worked to make this work possible. And the work that we're doing as part of the Multiple Measures Assessment Project is the work of a large variety of people: Greg Hayward, Terrence Willett, Loris Fagioli, Mallory Newell, Dan Lamory, Peter Barr have all been very important in getting this work done. So first what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the work that I did at Long Beach City College as the Director of Institutional Research there. We worked with CalPass Plus, which is a voluntary intersegmental data system for the state of California, to track students directly from high school who matriculated directly to Long Beach City College. And we did that to make sure that we were eliminating any other possible knowledge or training they could have picked up. They didn't go to another college. They didn't go to a four-year college. They didn't pick up additional skills in the workplace. So we wanted to track students directly. And all we did really was to try and examine the predictive utility of anything that we could gather from students' high school performance or achievement data to predict two things: how students assess and are placed into the various levels of English and math at Long Beach City College, and how students perform in those classes. And ideally what you want with a high-functioning assessment system is an alignment between those things, that the things that you're using to predict, to place students are actually the same things that predict how students will perform. That's the goal of assessment, to put students into the courses where they will be able to do the work of the class. So, what we did first was we looked at what predicted what level students would place at in our developmental education sequences. And so I'm just going to show you some regression coefficients. Larger numbers mean a higher or stronger relationship. And so the first thing we looked at is what predict placement. And the strongest predictor of how students placed was how they did on their last California standards test in mathematics, so a high school standardized test that we use in the state of California. And you can see that's a very powerful predictor. In fact, it's wildly significant. It's an exceptionally powerful predictor. It's basically a test-retest correlation to give you a sense of what the size of that is. For the performance in their last math course actually was a non-significant but moderate predictor, but it did not have a significant relationship with how students were placed. And students' overall performance in high school had absolutely no relationship with how students placed into our mathematics sequence. Now, if the how students perform in math looks the same as this, then we have a high-functioning assessment system. But we're all here today, so I think you can all imagine that it's going to look very different, and in fact, it does. What predicts student performance in mathematics is quite different. How they did on their last standardized test tells you a fair amount, but is much smaller in proportion to how they did in their last math class and, importantly, their overall high school GPA. So one of the things that I just wanted to underscore that Judith said earlier was one of the things we constantly find is that the students' overall performance across 4 years of high school tends to be a very powerful and reliable predictor and is almost always the first thing out of an analysis when looking at predicting college outcomes. So what we did at Long Beach City College was we reimagined student capacity. So starting in fall 2012, we provided an alternative assessment to students, reverse engineering the analysis I just showed you, placing students based on their overall high school GPA, their last high school course, so how far they got in math, their grade in that course, how they did in the standardized assessment, because that continues to be predictably useful, just not as much. And then we placed students in the highest course where their predicted success rate was at least as high as the average success rate for that particular course. And so I just want to give you a sense of what our placement into transfer-level math, what folks outside of the California Community College system would often call college-level math, so things like college algebra, statistics, or higher courses than that. And so at Long Beach City College, we generally place slightly less than 10% of students into a transfer-level math course of some kind. And so the first bar gives you the placement for the previous cohort of students from our local feeder high school district. And the blue bar then gives you the placement for the students that we provide the alternative placement to in fall 2012, but what their placements would have looked like if we had continued to use the test alone. And you can see that it's basically the same as the previous cohort. But when we actually use the evidence from students' reliable and consistent performance over 4 years of high school, we get a very different picture of students' preparation for transfer-level mathematics. And so we're placing about a third of students rather than a tenth of students into a transfer-level math course. So the first question that people have, unfortunately the axis here kind of exaggerates the differences, The first question that people have is whether or not that reduces success rates meaningfully. And in the first 2 years, there was a slight difference such that students placed via the alternative method had a slightly lower but not significantly lower success rates. But by the third year, you can see students who are going through the sequence, who are placed by the test, are taking courses from the same instructors in the same classrooms, are performing exactly at parity, and there's 2 to 3 times as many students that are getting into transfer-level courses that way. We are not the only ones that are finding this, so you can see some really nice examples of folks that are doing this at scale. Davidson County Community College and Ivy Tech Community College has been doing this work relatively at scale quite recently. There was a nice report by the Center for the Study of Community College Student Engagement recently. I highly recommend you read it, but two of the examples that they point out are these two colleges, and what they find is that you can use a relatively simple, straightforward rule. For Ivy Tech, they just use students who had a cumulative high school GPA of 2.6 or higher, essentially B-minus or better students overall. And Davidson County Community College used that same rule plus a proxy for the rigor of students' preparation, essentially that they had at least taken 4 years of mathematics, including the year beyond Algebra 2, as a way to understand whether or not students were essentially on a college or taking a college-directed curriculum in high school. And what they find is that students are much more likely to be successful if they're being placed by high school data than those students in the same courses being placed by the typical methods that they've used in the past. So it's not the case that this is a one-off or specific to Long Beach City College. And so just to give you a sense of what some of the impacts of that are, what we looked at is the percentage of students who are completing the gateway course or the transfer level course in mathematics within the first 2 years to give students who are placed in developmental education some time to catch up. And so in the previous cohort, only about 13% of students complete transfer level math in the first 2 years. And you can see some pretty typical equity gaps with Asian and white students much more likely to complete in the first 2 years than African Americans and Hispanic students. In contrast, by using students' performance in high school and part of our assessment process, we get almost double the total number or double the rate of students being placed into and succeeding in transfer level math in their first 2 years, successfully completing it with a C or better. And the interesting thing that you can see, I'm going to draw two lines here. The lower line is the average performance in the previous cohort, and the upper line is the performance of the highest performing demographic group in the previous cohort. And so you can see virtually every group now is exceeding the previous average performance, and the new average performance, or the new average completion rate of transfer level math is actually higher than the highest performing group in the previous year. If this had been an intervention applied only to students of color, it would have been one of the most successful equity gap closing interventions in the history of the California Community Colleges. So that's led to a variety of other projects, the Student Transcript Enhanced Placement Study that the RP group has done, which has then grown into the Multiple Measures Assessment Project, which is a collaborative effort of the Common Assessment Initiative, the California Community Colleges Chancellor's Office, CalPass Plus, which is what we manage with San Joaquin Delta, the RP group, and now 58 different pilot colleges representing over a million community colleges students. And we're identifying, analyzing, and validating different multiple measures approaches, including student high school transcript data, also drawing in non-cognitive variables and self-reported data. And we're doing this for English, math, ESL, and reading, focusing on predictive validity, with the key variables being anything that's predictably useful. But again, the biggest one that almost always comes out of every analysis is high school GPA. And then we're engaging with all the pilots to conduct local replications, test the models, and pilot their use. And you can see where you can find out more information at the Multiple Measures Assessment Project homepage and the rule sets that we've developed based on this work. Just to give you a sample of what we expect based on previous cohorts, historically in the California Community Colleges, we placed about 15% of students into transfer level math across the colleges. If you look at amongst students who take courses, about 31% of students take transfer level math as their first course, which suggests and is consistent with other community college research center work that a lot of students placed into developmental education never start the sequence. And what we project is based on this that you could actually expand the number of students placed into transfer level math to somewhere north of 40%. And we very carefully mapped out what students who've had those types of attributes in the past, what their success rates have looked like, matching them to individual students, and what we suspect, and this is supported by some of the other work I already showed you, that this shouldn't have a significant impact on students' success rates in those courses. So there are a variety of different concerns that people often bring up about this, and so I'm just going to skip super lightly through all of these things since we want to make sure to save time for questions at the end. But people often will say things that students placed via multiple measures will not be successful. You've already seen that that's not the case. Our test is different, or our system is better or more awesome. I'll talk a little bit about that, or it won't work in a cooler type of institution. students are better off going through developmental education, even if you could place them higher. This is going to interfere with students' ability to transfer because they're maybe more likely to get a B or a C. High school GPA only works for recent graduates, or it's too hard to get or use transcripts, or it might threaten my enrollment or FTS, or it's super complicated. It's going to take a long time to do this. So those are all things that come up. It turns out that most of them in the limit really aren't true. So let me just give you a quick overview of some of those things and point you to resources where you can find more information. So your task, your system, your school, your segment is exceptionally unlikely to be different. When Compass looked at this, when they validated their tests, you can see that with the exception of predicting performance in arithmetic, in all the other cases, high school GPA is a better predictor of performance in algebra, intermediate algebra, and college algebra than the relevant Compass tests. We've looked at this with AccuPlacer in the Multiple Measures Assessment Project, looking at student performance in all the various levels of mathematics. And you can see in every case, students' cumulative GPA at 11th grade is actually a better predictor of student performance than their score on AccuPlacer, which suggests, and the reason we use 11th grade is so that you can use this even for students who are matriculating directly, for whom it might be harder to get 12th grade data in a timely fashion. There's a really nice set of data that Brad Bossian from North Carolina has shared from the Belfield and Crosta paper in 2012, looking at the predictive utility of high school GPA versus all the different tests and subtests that they used in placement. And you can see high school GPA is a better predictor than virtually everything else, almost twice as good. And then Michelle Hedera, who's on this call, did a very nice paper just came out a few weeks ago looking at the predictive utility of the SAT, the ACT, and AccuPlacer compared to high school GPA for students who were going to two-year colleges or bachelor or four-year colleges or being bachelor degree oriented in the University of Alaska system. And again, you can see the same pattern over and over. Students' high school GPA is by far a better predictor of student performance in math at the University of Alaska than any of the things that we use to place students into those sequences or assess their readiness for it.
Hey, John, I don't think we're going to be able to go through all of these. Do you want to go to the summary now?
Sure.
And then I think we'll get to some of these issues during the Q&A, hopefully.
Okay. So on average, what the evidence suggests is that multiple measures and some of these other techniques can maintain or improve success rates in transfer-level courses, dramatically increase the placement and completion of the sequence. The majority of concerns that people have, genuinely held, when you actually start to look at them, don't actually hold much water and may reveal more about what we believe about students and their preparation than what the evidence actually suggests. And coupled with work on acceleration, co-requisite DevEd, and cut score reform, it demonstrates that we've been systematically and substantially underestimating our students' capacity, right? This capacity of students at your campus until you get back there to implement this type of work. And this type of thing can be an order of magnitude more effective at changing student outcomes and reducing student equity gaps than virtually any other initiative that we apply. And it tends to be very inexpensive and possible with existing staff and resources.
Great. Thank you so much, John. That was a great summary. I know you had more to say. We are going to now hear from Eric Hsu, and Eric's role in this webinar is important because most of what we've talked about so far, with a few exceptions, has focused on community colleges, and Eric sits at a four-year university system, and we're looking forward to hearing from him. So you're up, Eric.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Pamela. I'm Eric Hsu. I'm professor of mathematics at San Francisco State University, which is in the California State University system. I very much have a user perspective on this, so I'm really fascinated by the research that's been presented already. I help organize on campus our developmental algebra sequence and also serve on the CSU system-wide committee that designs the entry-level math test that I'll be telling you about. So I'm going to just start by telling you a bit about the general situation, just the statistics of what's happening now, and I'm going to talk about five big challenges for our current placement status quo. So there are about 64,000 students across 23 CSU campuses, and there's a system-wide policy that they all have to meet an entry-level math requirement. 53% of them are exempt through various reasons. So this is our version of multiple measures, and it's basically tests and high school coursework, and I'll show you in detail what that means in a couple of slides. After those 53%, all these percentages in the left column are absolute percentages of the 64,000 students. So 11% of the entering students then pass, so the others who are not exempt have to take an entry-level math exam. It's a standardized test given by ETS. 11% of the incoming students pass the test, so that's about 30% of the test takers, and the cut scores are set centrally. If you don't pass the test, you have to take Early Start coursework over the summer before you enroll, and 8% take the coursework and do sufficiently well that they fulfill the requirement. So that leaves about 27% of the students, and they have to take the so-called remedial classes, so developmental algebra, and 24% of the incoming students then pass the remediation classwork within a year, and that's basically non-college credit bearing algebra 1 and 2. The year is important because there's a system-wide policy that if you don't pass within a year, then you are disenrolled automatically, and you have to fulfill the requirement usually at a community college and then hope to transfer back. So about 12% of the remediated students get disenrolled, and that's about 3% of the incoming. So you can see that there's the tension that Professor Adaro was talking about, autonomy versus consistency. There's consistency in the test and the cut scores and the deadline and that Algebra 2 should be in the remedial classes, but there's complete autonomy about what the coursework and pedagogy is like across the different campuses. And as was mentioned before, there is a disproportionate impact on women, Latinos, and African Americans as far as the placement policies. The other thing I want to say is that earlier speakers mentioned that, of course, it's really disappointing if students drop out entirely from college due to extra remediation that's required, but also the students who stay get set back on any kind of STEM career that they might want. There's a lot of evidence that students who delay taking the advanced math classes do worse at completing the STEM majors. So I'm going to quickly buzz through what to do about this test. So let me tell you a bit about how you can get exempt from the test. You can see SATs and ACTs and AP classes, and all students have to endure this Smarter Balanced test in high school, and if you do sufficiently well, you get exempt. And then if you do almost that well, then you can take a senior year math, and then you can also be exempt. So there are actually a fair number of ways to be exempt from the test. And the number of exemptions has been growing over time, and that has resulted in a test pool. The people who end up actually taking the test, it's shrinking, and the scores have been going down. So that's one of the reasons why you get something like 30% pass rate of the people who make it to the test. And that has a number of bad results. So first of all, it just looks bad. It is bad face validity if you have a test that looks easy. Now, why should the test look easy? It's because due to test statistics, you want to have test questions that distinguish between the students who are taking the test. And so that means that when the committee members submit questions that are too hard, they get rejected because they don't discriminate sufficiently amongst the test pool. Secondly, so that means you get a test that has things that don't look like high school math, and that makes people upset. Secondly, ETS pre-tests test items, which is a good idea because you don't want test items that have strange response patterns or disproportionately do badly with certain subgroups. And so they pre-test the items, but now the test pool has been shrinking, so you're pre-testing it on a smaller group that's not really representative of the broader student population. So the test itself is under pressure as far as its validity goes. The second issue is that I mentioned that exemptions had been growing. They're really set to explode now because in the past there was something called the Early Assessment Program where you could voluntarily take extra 15 questions on the California standards test, which you can imagine not every student wants to take on. And in the past, that meant that there were 21,000 students who were deemed ready, 85,000 conditional, and 100,000 not ready using this voluntary test. Starting from 2015, they've replaced these extra questions and made early assessment possible automatically just by a subscore of the new Smarter Balance test. And so that means that in 2015, 46,000 students were deemed ready. So this is a huge increase in the number of students who are exempt, even though if you look at the actual distribution of performance, if you just randomly take many more students taking the test, especially ones who maybe wouldn't have opted into the questions, you would expect a decrease in overall performance, and that is what you get. But there are just so many more students now who are being assessed in this way that we're expecting a huge surge in the number of students who are going to be exempt, and this is going to be a real test of how well our current placement system works and how well the students are going to do in college-level math. So the test itself was created in 87 by a number of Cal State math faculty who just did their best to figure out what students needed to know to succeed in college-level math, and it was revised in 2002, but this is all before the Common Core, and I think before a lot of this recent research that we've been hearing about, which shows that there are these really serious attrition effects that happen just through an inaccurate placement. And this was recently kind of brought to a boil when our host, Pamela Birdman, released, tongue-in-cheek, a bootleg a copy of an internal report that ETS had, which showed, at least the report showed, that you could succeed in college-level math without the remediation. So when you actually looked at the report, I think the data was bad and basically unusable. And that's because of various reporting issues that you can talk to me offline about. However, it's very damning that we don't have any good data that's actually good. This is the kind of thing we want to know. And so it's a challenge for us to make sure that we really are putting students in a position to succeed, and we're lacking that kind of data right now. And just all the other studies that you've been hearing just are really alarming. And so one likes to think that the four-year college is completely different, but how different can it be? I think that this is an important issue for us to examine with more research. It was mentioned earlier that high school GPA is a huge important factor in multiple measures, and I would love to see how that works out at the CSU level. I mentioned using high school GPA to an administrator, and they almost started crying in front of me. I think it was because of the perceived difficulty of the logistics of getting the data and processing it, but somehow Long Beach managed to do something like this. So I believe we need to look further into this. The fourth issue is this issue of mandatory placement versus advisory placement. So I recently worked on this Mathematical Association of America, a national study of college calculus, where we looked at a number of is a national survey and then also 16 case studies of successful programs. And they found that, number one, pre-calculus, so even though it's about calculus, it's kind of a parable for developmental algebra, they found that pre-calculus classes were very bad preparation for calculus. Success in pre-calculus did not necessarily correlate to success in calculus. And then secondly, about half of the schools did not have mandatory placement, and half the schools did. And I'm at a mandatory placement school, as I believe every single CSU is. And when you're at a school like that, you have this feeling that, you know, if you can't let the students pick where they're going to end up. So you might imagine a different program where students take the placement test, and then they get advising and somehow are steered towards an appropriate class. But I think there's almost this ideology among faculty that, well, if we don't force the students into the class that they need to be in, then mass chaos is going to follow because they're just going to take whatever class they want. And so they've almost internalized this tension that Hedera was talking about progression versus standards. But as we can see in calculus, it's not necessarily so. And then in San Francisco State, English also has moved to a kind of non-mandatory self-placement and there does not seem to be chaos in the streets. So I would personally like to see the system allow a certain amount of autonomy for piloting these kinds of advisory placement models. The final challenge is just that the world is changing. First of all, there are now alternative developmental math models. So Statway is a kind of famous one, and it's been adopted at a couple of Cal State universities. And this is a kind of a program where you have two semesters and you start from Algebra 1, but you end up having a semester of college-level math, specifically college-level stats. And they do it by skipping a lot of Algebra 2. And so that leads to this challenge that you have students who are hitting college-level math but maybe have not been certified to have mastered Algebra 2. So that's a possible issue, and that's not really been thought out well. The second issue is that the world is changing. There's a Common Core. People are realizing that there are different ways to teach math where maybe more students can become effective, maybe with better differentiation, better attention to student identity. There are ways that you can increase the number of students getting through and succeeding in math. What's taught in math is changing. The world is changing. And so there's a need for more study of data analysis and statistics, more thoughtful use of technology. And so our current placement system is optimized for someone's good ideas in the 80s. So things are likely to be reconsidered. There's probably going to be a working group assembled to look at our placement policies and to recommend changes to the specifications of the test and our system-wide remediation policy and what we expect students to know. So this is a kind of pregnant time full of potential, and so it's been really fascinating to hear the other researchers and their takes, and I hope that there will be positive changes in the near future.
Great. Thank you very much, Eric. Very relevant set of thoughts for us, and it's also very relevant. Some of you may know CSU has a quantitative reasoning task force that is working on some of the issues that Eric mentioned, including the alternative pathways. And the task force has not directly looked at placement, but they are going to be recommending that CSU take another look at placement. So hopefully they will be able to follow up on some of Eric's recommendations if that happens. So we've gotten a number of questions in. I'm just figuring out where to start. I think we'll start with Judy. We had a question about how to look at over and under placement without considering the predictive model. And I think this means, you know, if you're looking at your own institution, how would you go about seeing, you know, the extent of over or under placement?
I think part of it, a little bit of it, is just a perception shift, just being aware that there are mistakes on both sides. And I think usually the overplacements are the ones that are really easy to see and are kind of sometimes dramatic and painful for everybody involved. So they're kind of very obvious. And I think just being aware that underplacement is a little bit more kind of hidden and insidious, in the sense that if you don't know what you're looking for, it might actually look like a good thing. Like, look, our students are actually, you know, they're taking remediation and they're getting A's and they're going on to do great things. That could be okay, but it could also be a sign that maybe there are some students in there that didn't really need it. So I'm not sure there's a way to estimate it without having data. But just kind of being aware that it is an issue, and thinking as an institution, what are the costs and what are your own values as an institution about how much you worry about one type of error than another.
Thank you, Judy. We have another question. This one's for Michelle about the changes in New Jersey when they were using decision zones. Did that significantly and substantially increase predictive validity of their placement process? Do you know?
I don't think they did any sort of study after they implemented the decision zones, so there's no information about the predictive validity, but it just gave the colleges some flexibility to place students with different measures if they fell along that around the cutoff score. So I would, based on Judy's research, I would, you know, expect it to improve placement of students, but they didn't do it a study.
Right. And, well, let's ask John, though. Did any of the examples you shared show a significant and a substantial increase in predictive validity?
So the ones that we did at Long Beach City College when we involve other types of metrics in really improves our ability to predict performance. The other thing that you can do even locally without some of this other data is actually model out the effects of different instructors that you have, because one of the big powerful impacts on student performance is the instructor to which they're assigned, and that's something that we often don't talk about. It's, you know, the third rail of these types of conversations, but it's something that every college has easy access to understanding how students are likely to perform in their classes. But absolutely, it does improve the predictive validity of understanding which students are most likely to succeed.
Great. Another question, I guess this one is for John also. This is, the questioner says the multiple measures movement is excellent, is an excellent one, but does want to raise the question of, is the only task of developmental math to prepare students for a single transfer level course, or how do you address the questions of being ready for quantitative reasoning more broadly in their majors or their gen ed interests in their careers?
So when we've branched out to include the, essentially a broader predictive outcome, right? So things like whether or not students are likely to do well in related courses, or whether or not students are likely, or in content related courses. So in the sciences, for example, or we do the same thing in English, looking at student performance in high reading and writing courses like history, an introduction to history or political science or sociology course, which might involve a lot more reading and writing than some other courses may have. And what we find is that you see the same predictive relationships. In fact, sometimes you see that you get a better understanding of the complete student's level of preparation for those other courses by using the complete suite of high school performance than you get from looking at their performance in what we typically use as the gateway course to that, right? So whether or not they did well in a math course as a predictor of sciences, or whether or not they did well in an English course as a prerequisite in some cases for performance in these other courses. And what you see is that you get an enormous amount of information that's very predictably useful for understanding students' likelihood to succeed in those other arenas by looking at how they've succeeded in 4 years of courses across many of those arenas. And so this work very strongly speaks to understanding students' likelihood of being able to do well across quantitative reasoning in the broad kind of STEM area and reading and writing in the broader college curriculum.
Okay, thanks, John. Now we have a question. It doesn't specify a presenter. I'm going to try Eric for this one. It's not directly on placement, but the question is about StatWay statistics pathways creating sort of a dual track for remediation, and how do you address racial and gender equity concerns if you have, you know, more than one track? Any thoughts on that, Eric?
That's a really good point. So, I mean, one of the dream of tracking is always that, oh, you put students in exactly the right level for them, and then you have these more homogeneous groups. So, in theory, you can be more efficient in your teaching. But if you don't have easy ways for people to go between the tracks, then you do risk underserving the low track, which is what typically happens. I don't think we're close to that as far as our thinking goes. I think it's more of a theoretical question that what if you have students that take StatWay but don't review Algebra 2, and so won't they be underprepared for the next class? I guess I'm not convinced that you need all of Algebra 2 in order to succeed at college level math, And so that's something that I hope we will research, and I think it's something that will be certainly in the forefront of everyone's mind if there are really inequitable outcomes that come out of any possible tracking system.
Thank you for that. We have another question. It looks like this one is for John. Again, the person is saying multiple measures are good and it's great to be more predictive, but you want to influence student behavior so that more students can clear the bar. Is there some plan with this project to help students understand what they need to do in high school in order to get placed into the transfer level math courses?
So to say there's a specific plan, that's not really the purpose of this project. But one of the things that you see at a huge set of colleges that start doing this work is it actually reopens and re-energizes the collaborative relationship between K-12 educators and higher education educators by basically stepping back and recognizing that the preparation that's happening at K-12 has been far better than it's been given credit for some time, and that lack of credit to that has been a function of using really a single instance, single method indicator of student performance that doesn't really capture the whole picture. And so it really gives you an opportunity to re-energize that relationship. And so one of the things that often happens pretty quickly after this work starts is conversations happen that start feeding counselors at K-12 information about what types of courses are really functional for improving your likelihood of success in college. And then you actually start to get into these really interesting spaces where you're now starting to build pathways for students so that they can improve and change their behavior to get to the college outcomes that they want. It's some really fantastic and powerful, you know, relationship building opportunities.
So we have a lot of questions coming in, and I'm sorry we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but let me at least pick one more here. The issue is about community college students coming to test without submitting transcripts. How appropriate is it to use self-reported GPA? Again, I think, John, you've dealt with this before. Is that right?
Sure. So self-reported GPA, both the College Board and ETS find that it's actually typically pretty well correlated. So the correlations range from about 0.7 to 0.85, a little bit higher in some cases. And in generally, especially for higher performing students, so students above like a 2.0 or higher in high school, if anything, they tend to underreport more than overreport. And one of the things that's an easy kind of fix for this type of thing is to do something that the University of California does when it has students submit unofficial transcripts. It just tells students that they'll check, right? And as anyone who's ever given assignments in a college course where you don't actually intend to check every single thing, when you tell students that you're going to check and you do some spot checking, typically students will tell you the truth, and that's exactly what the University of California has found. The vast majority of students report their grades exactly correctly. I think in 2008 what they found was across 60,000 submitted applications and the 9 different colleges, no college had more than 5 students misreport their grades.
Well, thank you, John. We are just about to run out of time. I have a comment from someone saying we hope we're not back in 5 years discussing equity concerns over students being funneled away from majors that lead to middle-class careers, and I think that's something to keep an eye on. I want to thank the panelists for a very rich discussion, and I want to thank the participants for joining us today and for sending in your questions. I hope you agree that this research is helping the field think more deeply about how to improve both equity and efficacy of placement testing. The webinar will be posted on the websites of Opportunity Institute and LearningWorks, and I again want to thank those two organizations, as well as the James Irvine and the College Futures Foundation, whose funding made these webinars possible. We're going to take a brief summer hiatus, and our next webinar in the Quantitative Leap series will be in August, focusing on using the senior year of high school to improve students' math readiness. Please stay tuned for more information on that webinar and more to follow. And thank you again very much for joining us today.